The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Thursday, March 16th, 2023. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Cedar, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Kate Aronoff, staff writer at The New Republic, on GOP efforts to target so-called ESG. And later in the show, Trita Parsi of the Quincy Institute will be joining us to discuss the Saudi-Iranian normalization agreement. Meanwhile, the Trump-appointed federal judge heard arguments on banning the abortion pill yesterday. A ruling could come at any moment. Walgreens said it would comply with any abortion pill ban, and now Walgreens' pharmaceutical distributor of the drug has followed suit. So much for woke corporations, am I right? Switzerland's central bank to loan Credit Suisse $54 billion to help strengthen its liquidity. A step short of a full-on bailout, but a bailout it still is. This comes as retail spending falls and economists raise the probability of a recession. The Biden administration has finalized a rule forcing power plants and factories in Western and Midwestern states to cut smog-causing pollution, the so-called good neighbor rule. Jim Clyburn endorses Brandon Johnson for Chicago mayor. He's already fundraising for him. Interesting development. New figures show that deaths of pregnant women increased by 40% from 2019 to the year 2021 due to COVID. Georgia investigators apparently have another recording of Trump calling another Georgian election official, other than Raffensperger, pressuring them to overturn the election results in 2020. Despite labor's calls to nationalize the railroads, we're going in the opposite direction. The first major railroad merger has been announced in two decades. At least union jobs will reportedly be a part of that deal. Strikes persist in France, including sanitation workers. Macron's still attempting to move forward with raising the retirement age. And lastly, the White House is trying to force the Chinese government to sell its shares of TikTok or face a U.S. ban in a ploy to lose every youth vote. So authoritarian. All this and more on today's program. I know that for some people, they see it's very problematic that the Chinese government has shares in TikTok. I don't care at all. And I think it's immensely hypocritical because, yes, the United States doesn't have shares in Google or in Meta, but we have now troves of information proving that they have a very symbiotic relationship with the government in terms of sending information back and forth and privacy and all that good stuff. Yeah, let's be real here.
These sorts of laws throughout history, like, create even more bigotry after they're passed. So, like, I don't think it would have any real effect on whether people are spied on. I think all these apps spy on people all the time. That's, like, their business model.
Yes.
But this will create anti-Chinese sentiment, and I think that's, like, the actual product being pursued there.
We're seeing a rise in anti-Asian hate crimes in the United States. I don't think that that is a coincidence, but hello, everybody. It's an M-Majority Report Thursday. Hope everyone is doing well. Let's get into it. We have a great conversation. I pre-recorded it already with Trita Parsi coming up, but first we'll have Kate Aronoff. But before that, I wanted to highlight this piece in the American Prospect because I've been keeping just an eye on how Ro Khanna, who is the congressman that represents Silicon Valley, a lot of it, how he's been responding to the Silicon Valley bank failure. And, you know, it's been mixed, but this was a pretty scathing piece that I think everyone needs to read, and we'll give you a lot of the information in the second, in the American Prospect, about his close relationship with Silicon Valley. Now, Khanna has positioned himself as a progressive, said some progressive things in the past. And I've interviewed him. I've met him in person. I appreciated his support of Bernie Sanders, for example. But these kinds of red flags are notable because there's no kind of room for what you're about to hear the leftist wing of the Democratic Party.
Like, it's like red flagger versus like sports metaphor. Like, this is flagrant foul. Like what we're saying.
Right. Ejection.
Like what he does with this. Yeah, get him out of here.
Or at the very least, next time he gets an ejection. Here we go. Let's put this up. Representative Ro Khanna, who stumped aggressively for a depositor bailout at Silicon Valley. This is the subheader at the top. Now will solicit funds with David Sachs, one of the loudest supporters of that policy. This is just a bit of a recap of what we experienced. SVB's failure inevitably led to a weekend-long hissy fit, a special pleading for a government bailout from venture capitalists like David Sachs. Their insistence that the economy could be on the brink of failure worked. By Sunday evening, regulators announced that the federal government would be stepping in, meaning that all depositors would have access to their money by the following day. As banking expert Daniel Davies told The Prospect, these VCs could have easily covered whatever shortfall existed at their portfolio companies. The venture capitalists basically used the threat of thousands of startups shuttering as a political human shield to get a bailout. Yes, we've gone over that before. But the point here is that this venture capitalist is cozying up to Ro Khanna in the form of a fundraiser, and it's not just any venture capitalist. The co-author of Peter Thiel's 1995 book, The Diversity Myth, Multiculturalism and the Politics of Intolerance at Stanford.
Like, I want to dwell on that a little bit. Like, these guys are sort of credited with being these masters of investment, and they're just like culture edgelords who got on the right bet early on with PayPal, and they have a whole bunch of money to play with now.
It all comes back to PayPal, right? I mean, it's just incredible. And before, what's so funny, before David Sachs was at PayPal, he was at McKinsey. So just,
oh, great.
What wonderful water populist training there. Is swimming in. Yeah. He founded PayPal with Peter Thiel, and now he spends his time fundraising for the likes of Ron DeSantis, Blake Masters, J.D. Vance, and now I guess Ro Khanna.
Yeah, this is from this article. Teddy Schleifer's Puck News tweeted about how Sachs and his wife were hosting a fundraiser for Khanna scheduled for the end of the month. The price of admission ranged from $3,300 to $13,200. In a statement to The Prospect, Khanna said that the event was organized before SVB's collapse. And first of all, still a problem.
I don't care.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it doesn't matter if David SVB Sachs collapsed or doesn't. You should not be fundraising with David Sachs.
David Sachs has sucked for a lot longer than that. And it's clear where he stands on SVB. Well, more broadly, however, he said, politics is about bridge building and persuasion. David Sachs and I have disagreements, but we must find common ground. We find common ground on cutting bloated defense spending, opposing the Yemen war and the First Amendment. Having core convictions, but engaging with those who see the world differently, is so needed in our nation. And I'll just say this: no, it's not. Venture capitalists, none of these guys are needed. These are all charlatans, basically masquerading for investments. Their track record is BS. And like the return on investment for venture capital is extremely, extremely low.
Yeah.
And like they're a creation of basically the last 10 years plus of monetary policy, where instead of saying doing basic things like keeping people in their houses and expanding like union labor protections and stuff like that, we've been flooding the zone with cash so speculators like David Sachs could play with it. They are creations of our inability to actually address the root causes of problems. And like, of course this is going to happen. And like the idea that he shouldn't even be deciding any future economic priorities of innovation as like a venture capitalist, but the idea that a congressperson would want to consult with him about the military state, great, he has opinions that are like semi agreeable, I guess. I mean, we'll kick the tires on those a little bit, but like he should not be in this position at all.
No. And I mean, when you talk about their speculative vampiric nature, I guess, I mean, a lot of this has been on steroids since during COVID. these venture capitalists use the very low interest rates to make wild swings. And then when rates got higher and they were increased exponentially, in a move by Jerome Powell that we've criticized immensely on this show, that was a big contributor to the instability that we're seeing right now. And so these are the exact kinds of people you should not be hanging out with, let alone raising money with. Like, this is not just a exchange of ideas or a meeting that they're going to telecast and have a debate. He's raising money for him.
Yeah.
And like, other people that David Sacks raises money for, I mean, you have to understand that there's something that Sacks sees in Khanna that he also sees in DeSantis, that he also sees in Masters, that he also sees in Vance, and that should be immensely concerning to people.
And I'm wondering if Khanna isn't just extremely cynical himself. Some of these quotes here. First I want to read this one from Jeff Hauser of the Revolving Door Project, because I think it's pointed. That bailout-seeking bigots like Sacks are embracing Roe Khanna is a strong piece of evidence that Khanna's progressivism is more performative than genuine. Khanna will have serious work to do to repair this wild error in judgment. I co-sign that. And here's the thing that really bugs me. Furthermore, in a statement to the Prospect, Khanna suggested that fundraising with Sacks could spark a conversation for progressives to debate the merits of a Medicare for All system. The Prospect did not ask Khanna about his support for a universal healthcare system. Still, he said, unprompted, if progressives want to get policies like Medicare for All passed, we have to make the case. Let's have these conversations without compromising our convictions. Why are we having these conversations with venture capitalists that are raising money for you, bro?
Yeah, it's not a conversation.
That's cynical. This seems like a political liar to me. And I agree with Hauser. He has a lot to do to repair for this sort of stuff. Like, this is absolutely appalling to me.
Yeah, I mean, this is the author of this piece, Jared Bradley.
Facundo.
Writes after that, it's a strange move on Khanna's part. It's extremely unlikely that Medicare for All will find any traction during this congressional session. Legislation would probably have to pass broadly against East Palestine, pass to broadly assist East Palestine or Jackson for that matter. And the Republican House is unlikely to do any of that because they're referencing that he was talking about East Palestine and Jackson, Mississippi, to hedge his support for the SVB bailout. So
he's just deploying it as it's off the table. It's time to talk about it now. It's like how certain people endorse Tulsi and now all of a sudden they're the big Medicare for All defenders. But it's just like you invoke something that isn't actionable at the moment to make yourself look good. And like, this is a huge problem. Roe is a snake. Like, come on, man, make this better. Or, you know, you've confirmed what people have been saying about you with regards to being owned by venture capital.
Yep. And I think, you know, people dismiss that vote on denouncing the horrors of socialism as performative, but it was important. Like,
Yes.
You were on vacation, right? It's paying dividends, like, in just these recent stories that have been coming out about Katie Porter and Roe Khanna. I believe Katie Porter voted against it. Sorry, I shouldn't say that. But at least with Roe Khanna, I was like, that's suspicious and should tell you who he's speaking to, especially when he tries to position himself in the anti-war space. That means that you don't really have a general comprehensive understanding about U.S. empire and what Cold War politics have done to the world.
Yeah.
And so you can't be anti-war and still talk about endorse the United States' completely warped framing on socialism and communism, right? And what it has done to the world. When you're supposed to be combating U.S. empire, it's silly.
This sort of the whole libertarian thing, like, we're anti-war. I don't, like, Elon Musk is supposedly anti-war too, and he's a defense contractor.
Right.
So, like, I don't buy this stuff. I think it's as deep as when Roe Khanna invokes Medicare for All there.
Yes.
Or shallow, I should say.
And just to yes and that again, when you hear libertarians or guys like Elon Musk talk about an anti-war position, it's usually just because they think it's politically useful as a way to advocate for austerity. Because they're talking about cutting budgets, and they throw that out there to get appeals to people who might be a little bit more naive on that front. Well, with that said, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be speaking with Kate Aronoff about these Republican anti-ESG efforts. We are back, and we are joined now, again, a friend of the show, Kate Aronoff, staff writer at The New Republic, author of the book Overheated, How Capitalism Broke the Planet, and How We Fight Back. Kate, thanks so much for coming on.
Great to be back.
Yeah. So let's start by playing this, because I think this is helpful to analyze your piece with. Recently, over the past few weeks, there has been a push by Republicans, and they successfully passed it in the House and the Senate. Biden's going to veto it, but it's this denouncement of woke ESG policies. And a lot of Republicans are kind of running with this. I'm going to ask you what this really entails. But here's Kevin McCarthy making that case, and I know Larry Kudlow did as well today. They're really sticking with this. About Biden's woke ESG regulatory efforts.
Do you have a 401k or some kind of retirement plan through work? If so, what I'm about to tell you affects you directly. A new regulation from the Biden administration allows your retirement savings to be used to fund a political agenda you may not agree with. It lets Wall Street redirect your money into something called ESG investments. The goals of these funds isn't to maximize your return or grow your savings relative to other funds. These are woke priorities whose primary purpose is to push a far-left political activism. But there's good news. Republicans and a few free-thinking Democrats voted to block Biden's woke ESG rule. The House and Senate both passed it. I just signed it, and now it goes to the president's desk. Unfortunately, he is threatening to use his first veto against it. Now, I hope he changes his mind and sides with American workers over Wall Street. If not, it will really show us where his priorities lie.
Can I just say, like, there's so many cuts in that because Kevin McCarthy is really has a tough time stringing sentences together.
He's not very charismatic or intelligent.
He's all posed up.
Yeah, right. Like, so, okay, there's a lot there, right? One, yeah. I would say, hey, Kevin McCarthy, if you don't want Americans' retirement savings to be the at the whims of the market with 401ks, hey buddy, we can just strengthen Social Security, and how about expand Medicare? We'll just do that right away, bipartisan agreement. But like, I mean, what do you make of that, right? Biden is going to veto this, but the Republican fixation on this, it's an interesting tactic, to say the least.
Yeah, it's hard to know where to start, and in covering this genre of content, I feel like I return to the sort of hallmarks of thinking about climate denial and covering climate denial, which is like, if you try to go through and unpick everything that's wrong or false, you just like end up down a rabbit hole nobody particularly wants to be in. I will point out one thing of like the many inaccuracies in that clip, which is sort of ubiquitous across these sorts of talking points. But ESG funds, right? ESG stands for environmental social governance, is this very broad category of things. Kevin McCarthy is I think willfully sort of misrepresenting what is happening, which is that ESG funds in particular, so these are products that asset managers will sell to institutional investors like pension funds or retail investors to invest their money. ESG funds are a very specific thing and make up a very small percentage of the products that companies like BlackRock or State Street, the big managers, offer. So pension funds are not really going into ESG funds. What he's referring to in this sort of obliquely, very intentionally misleading way is that these companies have embraced a set of sort of investment priorities around ESG broadly, right? And so they, Larry Fink in particular, the CEO of BlackRock, has said that ESG factors are sort of an important consideration in how they make investments for entirely capitalistic reasons, right? And considering sort of climate risk, if you have a lot of investments in Miami real estate, for instance, is just a very material, important thing to consider for the returns of those assets. There's obviously a lot to unpack in that clip, but that would be the one that I will mention. And maybe just one more thing. Is that, the whole argument around this anti-ESG crusade is that it's threatening returns, when almost the opposite is true, right? And that, because you see Republican-led state governments starting to pull funds out of BlackRock, they're left to rely on a much more sort of niche set just less sort of optimal places to park pension money in, for instance. And because the asset management industry is so, so concentrated among the big three, which is, a problem in its own right, I think, many people of political stripes will argue, you're left with asset managers who just offer simply worse returns. And so if you're taking money out of a BlackRock, State Street, Vanguard, you're just going with worse products and worse, and can expect worse yields from, teachers and state employee retiree pensions.
And when it comes to 401ks too, it's just hilarious to me that anyone really the average person does not pay a ton of mind into what goes into their 401k, nor are they parsing through trying to make determinations about it. I mean, for a 401k, it's basically, what are you going to deduct? What are you going to put in? And that's really the extent of what people do when they're putting into their 401ks. And we were just talking about how the 401k is not a viable experiment for social insurance. And yet, this is the kind of future that people like Mike McCarthy or Kevin McCarthy want, not the Cowboys coach, Kevin McCarthy want, because they want to cut into our Social Security, into our social insurance as a way to funnel more money into Wall Street. And at the same time, he's saying Biden's siding with Wall Street because I guess Wall Street is so woke, right, that they just only care about diversity, inclusion, and climate change. But Biden is gonna veto this, right? But that's not really the end point for this, right? Like, they're ramping this up after they've already passed the bill through the House and the Senate. They're gonna try to use this as a PR campaign to then attack the administrative state, as you write about in the New Republic.
Yeah, and I've been tracking this sort of anti-ESG movement, broadly defined, for about a year. And for a while, I was very confused about where it was coming from, just because it's not clear sort of who is benefiting from this, or like why Republicans would particularly care about, this obscure sort of sustainable investment acronym or pension funds, which they, as you pointed out, routinely vote to dismantle. Routinely make decisions at the state and the federal level, which disadvantage retirees and retiree pension funds. And as I write in the piece, and as you noted, I think the only sort of thing I can make sense for what the prize of this is, which is not really to like disempower BlackRock in any meaningful way. Like, it's a, they have $10 trillion of assets under management roughly. And so, the amount of like these small state pension funds sort of withdrawing funds is that, seems not totally negligible, but not really the main prize here. But as you say, there is a sort of way that state state level policymaking happens increasingly, where it's easy for relatively small amounts of donor money to fund these sort of campaigns that can go national in the way that the American Legislative Exchange Council has done with a number of issues. So you can look at their sort of militancy against abortion, right to work, has followed a sort of similar playbook to what you're seeing with anti-ESG, and can galvanize these big sort of national level fights by enlisting states as kind of the foot soldiers within that. And particularly with this, because so much of the focus is on energy, they're looking at these sort of states who have historically relied a lot on extractive industries, like West Virginia, Kentucky, red states that have been really leading the charge in this from their attorneys general and state treasurer's offices, and just use that to galvanize this big fight. And what I think that fight is, as we're seeing now, is against the administrative state. So the first thing we have seen at the sort of federal level on this is this vote against this Department of Labor regulation, which all this regulation does is sort of allow pension funds to consider ESG. It doesn't mandate anything. It doesn't sort of make it so that these funds have to look at these sets of priorities, just establishes that that is an okay thing for them to do if they would like to. But it's a target in part because it's a very convenient way to go after the rulemaking authority of federal agencies, is to say that they're overstepping their bounds and going beyond the sort of mandate given to them by Congress, which is exactly the sort of challenge that John Roberts invited in his majority opinion on West Virginia versus EPA this summer, which many people thought would sort of dismantle big chunks of the administrative state, would really kneecap the EPA. It didn't quite do that. But what Roberts does in that decision is to say, here is this sort of very shaky legal precedent called Major Questions Doctrine, which you can use to basically bring a challenge to the administrative state generally on the grounds that Major Questions Doctrine basically holds that federal agencies should only sort of be allowed to do a very narrowly circumscribed set of things as outlined by Congress, and that the Supreme Court is the body which can make the decision as to whether these agencies are overstepping their bounds. So the DOL rule is one example of that. The other one, which will probably come up at some point in the next several months or years, is a challenge to a proposed Securities and Exchange Commission ruling on sort of reporting requirements around emissions. And so that, I think, is the main prize. It's like they want a big ruling that will overturn something like, you know, the Chevron doctrine, so one of these big sort of statutes that allows for the state to regulate what these companies do.
I mean, that's Roberts' version of what Thomas was doing in, I guess, the concurring opinion in Dobbs, right? Which is like, here's a roadmap for all the things that you can come to us, and it's just like it's a platter of pick what you want, and you can come. We'll attack affirmative action. We'll attack LGBTQ rights. Whatever you want, state legislatures. This is your roadmap, and then Roberts is just doing it a little bit more subtly, especially because for his purposes, that's the prize, right? The dismantling of the administrative state, as the more like corporate Republican, as opposed to, you know, QAnon believing adjacent guy like Thomas, right? And that's really just immensely concerning. And given the fact that, your reporting and who you spoke to at this conference that you were at, these oil and gas executives, given that their public position on things like ESG is very, you know, PR careful, and they're saying that they support it, but behind the scenes, they're clearly attempting to dismantle it because they want things like tax credits from the Inflation Reduction Act, because like, hey, we're trying to be green, right? We're a part of this solution too, but behind the scenes working with these Republican groups most likely to help in their efforts to overturn these kinds of things. Like, state Republicans have to know that this money is out there. If they need a kind of fund for their legal efforts to get rid of these regulations, they seem to see this ESG culture war wokeness stuff as a foot in the door.
Yeah, it's a very convenient line. And I think the role of the oil and gas industry here is interesting because they do genuinely have, you know, sort of a legitimate business interest in pursuing things like carbon capture and storage, which they have some sort of personnel expertise in. They have some of the sort of, you know, technology and infrastructure to do that, and, you know, are very excited about some of the tax breaks offered. At the same time, you know, they always want to have it both ways. And so you'll see people like the CEO of ExxonMobil, Darren Woods, or any of these big oil and gas CEOs saying, we're so excited to, you know, lead the way toward a low carbon transition. Transition to what? Nobody really knows. And then at the same time, through their membership in trade associations like the American Petroleum Institute, in some cases through, you know, the CEO of Devon Energy sits on the board of one of these organizations, is really pushing forward anti-ESG and spouts more of the sort of crude climate denial than you, you know, will see typically these days. But they want to have it both ways, right? They want both the sort of reputational benefits of being invested in the energy transition, which will win them friends among investors, and they want to take the tax credits, and they want to not be beholden to any sort of federal regulation at all. And, you know, that's been their playbook for a long time. And for the most part, they can do it.
This is a bit of an aside, but in hindsight, and I know that with the Inflation Reduction Act, we were kind of being held over a barrel by Manchin, but we should not have been incentivizing things like carbon capture, probably, right, from the United States. Because for these oil and gas companies, like, I understand that it has its value, but for oil and gas companies, is it not a way for them to have it both ways? Or am I overstepping there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a sort of complicated issue. I think what is definitely true is that oil and gas companies are treating carbon capture and storage, in particular now, especially with the Inflation Reduction Act, as a way to say, we're on the right side, we can handle this problem, you know, we are best positioned to lead the way to a clean energy future. But when you look at what they're actually spending, they're spending such modest amounts on carbon capture and storage. They're nice little, you know, now sort of tidy lanes of revenue, but they've reaped the reputational benefits. They sort of allow, you know, people to think that they're really sort of green and cleaning up their act. But they're investing such little money in it, which, you know, I personally think carbon capture and storage is a sort of important technology. Like, I think this is something that we will probably need. Most sort of climate modeling says we will need some significant level of it. I just don't trust these companies to do it because A, they're not spending very much money on it, and there's just not a profit model, right? The whole model of carbon capture and storage is that you get carbon from the sort of atmosphere through direct air capture or through industrial processes through carbon capture and storage, like attaching things onto industrial operations, and then you just keep it in the ground. Like, there's nothing, there's not really a revenue model for that, and should be a public good if we think it's so important, because we can't, you know, just trust companies to make money off this thing that, like, is very bad, a bad way to make money, which is the only thing that they know how to do.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So some of the executives you spoke to about the anti-ESG push here, what were some of the most interesting responses that you got, if you were able to glean anything from, like, the neat and tidy way that they're going to present to the public?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and I don't really think they're being so disingenuous here, because the thing that I have heard oil and gas executives say, and people in the industry and sort of trade publications say for a while, is that the reason that there has not been more investment in oil and gas production in particular over the last several years is that they spent 10 years losing money on the shale boom. They just drilled as much as possible, hemorrhaged investors' cash, and drove down the price of oil to the point where none of them were really making money, especially in the shale patch. And so the reasons why they, you know, their investors have been a bit more leery to say, go out and drill, go fetch these, you know, $100 per barrel prices, is because they, you know, misbehaved. They spent 10 years misbehaving and losing money. And what the anti-ESG movement says is very different from that. They say the reason there is not more oil and gas production happening, because we, you know, value that as some sort of moral good to be drilling for oil and gas, is because these woke investors are going around and telling poor ExxonMobil, poor Chevron that they can't drill because of the Green New Deal or something. And then you actually just ask executives whether, you know, Larry Fink pulling some green string is the problem and why they're not pouring more money into exploration and production. And they say no, you know, it's not a sort of narrative that like makes intuitive sense. And they're pretty clear about that. Like if anyone is actually paying attention to the sort of business press or what actual people in industry are actually saying, they will not say that the problem is like, you know, these woke investors peddling some green agenda. They'll say, we're getting our balance sheets back in order and we're actually profitable and making money for the first time. And we want to keep that up, which they're true. You know, they're not lying when they say that. But at the same time, this anti-ESG fight is very convenient. And so that even if they disagree with the basic premise of the argument or one of the basic premise of the argument, they are still, you know, perfectly willing to chase something that could mean they don't have to report emissions, that they don't have to, you know, abide by federal rules.
You also did some reporting on their kind of reaction to the Inflation Reduction Act more broadly, right? And their praise for it publicly. What's your sense now that the Democrats have lost the majority in the House of how some of these executives are feeling, and how that kind of pairs with this new ESG push, which as we went or anti-ESG push, which as we went over, Biden was clearly going to veto it. The veto brings more press to it. Then it's an opportunity for these attorneys general on the state level to do their thing and go after the EPA and its statutory authority and all that. In terms of that piece of legislation, what would you say is the broad kind of consensus reaction among some of these executives?
I think there's two major strains, the first being the less important, I think, which is that there are things, especially the very large oil and gas producers, are already doing, like carbon capture and storage, like sort of very nascent investments in hydrogen, in the sort of suite of technologies that are being incentivized by the Inflation Reduction Act, that they can, what's known as de-risk, right? And so the government will sort of shoulder the risk of those operations while they reap the reward. And so it's just more profitable and easier to get financing for carbon capture and storage products. That's a nice little revenue stream that they can grow as a nice sort of supplement to their main business, which is drilling and selling hydrocarbons. But I think the major reason why they seem so sort of positive about this and the vibe kind of at this terrible conference I was at was that it's a sigh of relief, right? There's a moment where they thought that there might be more stringent rules in what they're doing, that there might be more intense regulations, that the Inflation Reduction Act would actually threaten their business model in some way. And that's passed, right? The Democrats lost their majority. It's a divided Congress. It is not going to pass certainly ambitious climate legislation that poses any sort of threat to their business model. And so it's just this big sigh of relief that, you know, we will not, at least for the foreseeable future, have to worry about anyone coming and saying we can't, you know, just continue to drill up as many fossil fuels as possible for as long as we can make money off it. Like, they can do both. They can have the sort of reputational benefits, new revenue streams from these low carbon businesses, and they can continue to drill and sell as many fossil fuels as they want.
All right. Well, that's a bit troubling, but Kate Aronoff, I really appreciate your time today. You can read her work over at The New Republic and also read her book, Overheated, How Capitalism Broke the Planet and How We Fight Back. Thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
All right, guys, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I already had this conversation earlier this morning with Trita Parsi. We spoke about the Saudi Arabian Iranian normalization agreement brokered by China. It's a great discussion. We'll play that for you, and then when we come back, we'll head into the fun half. are back, and we are joined now by Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, a favorite of ours here at the Majority Report, here to discuss his latest piece on the Saudi Arabian and Iranian normalization agreement. Trita, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. So this is major. Iran, Saudi Arabia, they've come to a normalization agreement. The parameters are arguably less significant than how the agreement was actually reached and who helped them reach it. It was brokered by China and there was no United States involvement. Take us through the signage of this agreement last week.
Yeah, so I think, first of all, you're quite right. As it stands right now, this deal in and of itself is smaller than the fact that China stepped in and mediated it. Iran and Saudi Arabia have had good and bad relations up and down for many, many different years. And now we've had a 7-year slump, and that seems to have now come to an end. But there's not going to be a love fest. At least the normalization deal in itself doesn't guarantee that. Instead, they're going to continue to be rivals. But because of the normalization, that rivalry is now going to be much better managed. And that hopefully will then mean that they're not going to be recklessly spreading their rivalry throughout the region and turning other countries into an arena for their conflict. So that is fantastic news for most countries in the region, of course, assuming that things will go through as planned. It can lead to something bigger. It can lead to a much bigger strategic shift, but that is a much greater unknown at this point. But the fact that China stepped in and mediated this is extremely significant. Now, the Chinese were not alone. The Iraqis and the Omanis had been mediating and preparing the ground for this since 2019. But they couldn't really push it over the goal line. The Chinese came in and did that. And there were some apparently pretty intense negotiations just in the last couple of weeks from Xi visiting Riyadh, and then later on Raisi went to Beijing. So the Chinese role seems to have been quite significant, at least towards the end. And this is huge because China has traditionally not desired to play that type of a role in the Middle East. It was almost a given that China would never get itself involved in these different things. And now it has. It's been successful, and it's sending shockwaves, not just in the Middle East, but it's also raising question marks as to whether China's proposed mediation in Ukraine should be taken far more seriously than it was 2 or so weeks ago when it was first proposed and very quickly dismissed by Western powers.
Well, that dismissal, it colors it entirely differently, right? Because there's some parallels with this situation here where the United States has been unable to mediate any kind of relationship between Saudi Arabia and Iran because it is so hawkish on Iran, right? They do not have really a leg to stand on from the Iranians' perspective. Now, Russia invaded Ukraine. It's an asymmetrical situation. But at the same time, you know, China is positioning itself as a more neutral diplomatic power in this way. I mean, what is their end game? Obviously, now they have kind of developed a relationship between these two major oil powers in the region and has cooled tensions between the two, at least for now. What do you see as their the goal of their kind of shift on past history of diplomacy or lack thereof?
So let me address the goals second. Let me first talk about what you addressed first in your question, which is, you know, how come the U.S. couldn't do it and the Chinese could? It's not just that the U.S. is being very hostile towards Iran and vice versa. It's also what Khalid Al-Jabri and I write in Foreign Affairs yesterday. It's also because the United States, both under Trump and under Biden now, has been completely deferential to the Saudis. We're trying to hug MBS to death. So we lost credibility in the region, partly because we're part of all of these different conflicts instead of being neutral. And then secondly, because we've just completely bent over backwards for some of these states, which has then further embroiled us in their conflicts and further undermined any credibility we had to mediate. Now, I don't think that the United States easily could have mediated between Iran and Saudi Arabia in the first place. We could have had Trump not pulled out of the JCPOA, and we actually had 7 years of steadily improving relations with Iran, then it could be in a very different universe than we are right now. But obviously, Trump made sure that that didn't happen. But I think it goes beyond Iran and Saudi Arabia. The United States is not a trusted mediator in most parts of the Middle East. It's not just Iran and Saudi Arabia. And part of that is because
Israel-Palestine.
Israel-Palestine is the biggest example. I was going to get to that because we've actually made a point out of not being neutral. Remember back in the 1990s, Al Gore got a lot of criticism because he at some point had said that we would be an honest broker in the Middle East. It was some of the most hawkish pro-Israel voices that attacked him and said, no, America's going to be on the side of Israel. It's not going to be an honest broker. Honest broker means that we're neutral. We're not neutral. We shouldn't be neutral. Well, guess what? Not being neutral has meant over a course of years now that we have lost any credibility to be a trusted mediator. And perhaps we didn't see that as a particularly costly position because we were the only games in town. Now there is another game in town. And now suddenly we're seeing the cost of the United States branding itself as a partisan actor in the region, as someone who's on the side. It's not mediating. It's essentially Saudi Arabia's lawyer in the mediation between the Saudis and the Houthis. It's not an honest broker. We don't want to be an honest broker. Well, guess what? That's going to cost us a lot now because now the Chinese are stepping in. Now, what do the Chinese want? Well, first and foremost, countries do all of these different things because it's in their own interests. I wish we did it more that way, because if we're acting our own interest, there's so much in the Middle East and elsewhere that we wouldn't be doing. But China's doing this out of its own interest, and its key interest is that it needs to have stability in the Middle East because half of its energy is coming from the Middle East. And growing its economy, bringing millions of Chinese out of poverty, is the most important objective for the Chinese. By stepping in and reducing the tension between the Saudis and the Iranians, it's stabilizing oil markets, it's reducing the risk premium, and it's good for its economy. But it's also probably doing it for one other reason, or many other reasons, but one that I would want to mention, is the fact that the Chinese are also doing this because it brings Iran and Saudi closer to them, and if U.S.-Chinese tensions continue to rise, which they have been since the Trump years and continued under Obama, the Chinese want to make sure that in such a scenario, the United States is not going to be able to put pressure on Saudi Arabia to seize its energy relations with China, for instance. They want to have a guarantee by bringing the Saudis closer to them. And by doing this, they're also showing that China can be a constructive player on the international scene, which will make it much more difficult for the United States to brand China as a threat to the global order, as the new pacing threat that we have to go into a Cold War against. So China's doing it for its own reasons, obviously. What I think took everyone by surprise is the speed and the competence in which they managed to shift from being a country that stays out of these things to a country that is stepping in, mediating, and bringing it to a close.
Well, as you say, I mean, they were uniquely situated to do so based on their economic prowess and the fact that they were relatively neutral and had interest in this situation. And the United States has completely gotten rid of its credibility in the region. It's been, and Murtaza Hussein wrote about this in The Intercept, that the United States' role as an enforcer for, say, Saudi Arabia or Israel has not just burned its credibility with other countries, but it has also incentivized the countries that we have close relationships with to pursue aggressive military conquest or aggression, apartheid in Israel's instance, on their own because we were their enforcer behind the scenes. So it isn't just our impartiality that has created and helped exacerbate this mess, some of the messes that we see, but it's just the nature of how the U.S. wields power, which is very different than this kind of soft power strategy from China, one that I would wish the United States would pursue. And I think clearly demonstrating here that if you're stated objective is actually coming to some sort of agreement, it's much more effective, obviously.
Yeah, and those two things are very connected, of course, because it is our desire not to be impartial, which also means that we have given carte blanche to many of the states in the region to do whatever they want. And when they get themselves into trouble, which they invariably do, they count on us to have an obligation to come and bail them out. And that's what we've done with the Saudis in Yemen. That's what we're continuously doing as Israel continues to expand its occupation, illegal settlements, erode its own democracy in the process. None of this, in my view, would really been able to happen had we not enabled it to happen by thinking that we're actually doing them a favor by supporting such policies that they're pursuing. In fact, the reason, a key reason, as to why Saudi Arabia has shifted towards diplomacy with Iran is precisely because under Trump, they got a wake-up call. Because the Iranians attacked Saudi oil fields, the Saudis expected the United States to come and bomb Iran in retaliation as part of a long-standing policy dating back to the Carter years, the Carter Doctrine. And Trump explicitly said, I'm not going to go to war with Iran on behalf of Saudi Arabia. This was another moment of shock in Saudi Arabia, and they suddenly realized they can't hide behind American power as they could before. Well, if you can't hide behind America's military might, guess what? Diplomacy with your neighbors suddenly become much more attractive. And in that sense, our policy has actually been an obstacle to the regional diplomacy that we now are seeing happening for the last couple of years. And the reason why it's happening again is because more and more states have become convinced we are leaving the region. Even if we keep military forces in the region, we don't have the appetite to fight in or for the region. And as a result, they can't hide behind us, and they need to resolve their own tensions themselves and build their own security with their neighbors themselves. And guess what? That's actually a really good thing. Not just for them, it's good for us as well. All we need to do now is to encourage it more, make sure that it moves in a stable way instead of being disruptive, and bring American troops home.
But the fear probably from the Biden administration is that, oh my gosh, our major buddy that we've completely, you know, bent over backwards to, you know, kiss the ring of MBS or bump the fist rather, they are becoming close to our arch rival. And the United States has been, and I think, you know, we've done a few interviews on this, I'm immensely concerned that the Biden administration's being reckless in its China hawkery with these deals with Australia, the reopening of military bases in the Philippines, the consistent hawkishness to drum up this rivalry. I mean, that I would imagine also motivates China. But when it comes to the Saudis, why are Biden's appeals that are embarrassing, honestly, from a progressive perspective, where he says we're going to make Saudi Arabia a pariah state and then he's cozying up to MBS, why are they falling on deaf ears with Saudi Arabia? Like, why has the regime in Saudi Arabia, despite the U.S.'s consistent, you know, forgiving of its misdeeds and human rights abuses, choosing to kind of say, well, you know, I want to dance with another?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And it goes back to what we talked about before. First, you have the U.S. say, hey, we're not going to fight for you. And then the Saudis start so well, then they have to start looking elsewhere. They're doing diplomacy with Iran. They're moving closer to China. Then we got a panic. Somewhere in the summer after the withdrawal of Afghanistan, there was a major change happening in the White House. Originally, there were plans to actually withdraw a significant amount of troops from the Middle East. Then that suddenly was completely changed. And the argument, the winning argument in the NSC was, well, we're going to have this major confrontation or competition with the Chinese. And that competition is not going to take place in the South China Sea alone. It's going to take place in Africa, in Europe, in Latin America, and in the Middle East. And as a result, we cannot withdraw troops. We cannot weaken our relations with these partners. However, problematic those relations have been. Instead, we have to double down on them in order to make sure that in the competition with China, we take advantage of what the White House saw as our main strength, which is this alliance system. Take a look at what Colin Cowell, Deputy Secretary of Defense, said at one of his speeches in IISS. He said that the competition with China is not a competition between two states. It's a competition of alliances, coalitions. So we really need to bring them closer. That's why we suddenly saw that shift. And it manifested itself in Saudi Arabia in the sense that all the talk about pariah, all the talk about MBS is going to pay for how he's manipulated oil prices, all of that came to nothing. And we did not put pressure on him. Instead, we supported him in many different ways, including in Yemen. And then the question comes to your point. So why didn't the Saudis agree to it? Well, because once we were essentially bending over backwards for MBS, MBS was like, well, why don't you bend over a little bit more? I want formal security guarantees from you, the United States. I want you to commit American women and men to die for my country. So he's not gonna meet the Biden team halfway unless he gets that. It's been one of the key demands of the Saudis that they've been repeating. And to Biden's credit, at least I have to say, we've so far not been in the mood of offering that. I mean, that would be a major, major change in U.S. posture. We would, because all of these other beliefs that we had to come to their defense were based on understandings, not formal treaties. Saudi Arabia is not a formal ally of the United States. It's a security partner, but there is no treaty agreement with them. That's what the Saudis are asking for right now. And there is a possibility that this whole normalization with Iran is part of MBS's negotiating tactic with the U.S., in which he's trying to raise the cost of the United States not offering him written security guarantees. But if he were to do so, and it would be truly formal, it would have to go through the Senate. And I very much doubt that the United States Senate would agree to such an agreement.
Yes. And then when it comes to Iran's position here, I mean, their potential new connection with China has to undercut any kind of re-upping of the Obama-era nuclear agreement, right? I mean, I know those talks have already been falling flat under Blinken, but any hope? My guess is that this dwindles those kinds of hopes since, you know, the United States' effort to isolate Iran took a blow with China's involvement here.
It's going to be interesting to see how it plays out on that issue. It has been on ice. It has been on ice for many different reasons. The last round of talks that took place in August of last year, the Iranians came in with last-minute demands that really, unfortunately, caused those talks to collapse. Then you had the uprisings in Iran, and then you had the midterms in the United States. So all of that led to a situation in which talks were put on ice. Then on top of that, the Iranians started supporting Russia in the war in Ukraine. And that all has led to a situation in which the cost for the Biden administration to go back in, the political cost to go back into the JCPOA has significantly increased, particularly the combination of Ukraine and the manner in which the Iranian government has treated its own people over the course of the last couple of months. On top of that, you've had a significant change of heart in Europe. Europe never saw the Iranian nuclear program as an immediate threat. The bigger threat was that we would go to war with Iran over the nuclear program. That was a threat to Europe. So Europeans stepped in for the diplomacy in order to make sure that that scenario didn't happen. With Iran supporting Russia, and the Europeans increasingly seeing Russia as an existential threat to the European order, suddenly their view of Iran has changed dramatically, and Ukraine takes way bigger priority than the nuclear program. So the political mood and the political space for this on the Western side has shrunk significantly. At the same time, there's been no indications that there's a more open attitude to it on the Iranian side. After this normalization deal, however, I think there are reasons to believe that it may potentially change, because this is a blow to any effort to isolate and contain and sanction Iran further. So one of the cards that the U.S. had in their calculation of being able to, at some point when the U.S. itself was ready, which doesn't seem to be the case right now, pressure the Iranians to come back to the table, has now been undermined with this and a normalization deal. On the other hand, the Chinese are stepping in and showing that just because the U.S. doesn't have the political space to move forward diplomatically, doesn't mean that the Chinese are going to be sitting there on the sidelines and do nothing. So I think there is pressure momentum to do something, but it hasn't changed the political landscape in Washington, which on the U.S. side has been one of the main obstacles. The Biden administration always wanted the deal, but was never really willing to pay the political price for it. If they did, they would have just gone in on day one instead of the strategy that they chose. The sad reality is that the political cost of going in has steadily increased since day one when he came into office. At that moment, it would have been the least politically costly step to take. Now it's much higher. And that's going to continue to remain a decisive factor on determining how the U.S. reacts to this.
And it's frustrating. Last question before I let you go. How does this help and alleviate the suffering of the people of Yemen that we have some sort of normalization?
It hopefully will. At a minimum, we have to recognize that the Yemeni civil war has its own Yemeni roots. But Saudi Arabia and Iran has fueled that conflict by bringing their own rivalry into it. If they now withdraw it, that is good news. Is it sufficient to bring about a complete end to the civil war? We don't know. But it creates a significant opening and an opportunity for that to happen. There already is a truce. That truce has expired, but it's nevertheless largely been abided by. Will this give political momentum to move forward further and turn the truce into something more permanent? That would be one of the best outcomes, if it were to happen, from this normalization deal.
Preeta Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate
it. Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
We are back from our interview with Preeta Parsi. With that, we're going to wrap up the first hour of the Majority Report. We're going to be heading into the fun half with Matt Binder, Brandon Sutton, Bradley and Matt, and myself. And we'll take your calls, read your IMs. The number is 646-257-3920. But first, Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning?
Yeah, on Tuesday we had Dwayne Monroe on to talk about AI. We also talked about the Silicon Valley Bank sort of failure and the lack of reckoning with how we've basically just decided to paper over the financial crisis with giving a whole bunch of money to speculators and how that's still unaddressed. I mean, we should regulate these banks too, but we shouldn't be pumping money into this part of the economy anyway. this weekend, talking to Jamie Peck about Cop City.
Oh, cool. Yep,
patreon.com/leftreckoning.
Oh, that's great. And she's down there, right? Still?
I'm not sure if she's still down there. She did a video for Means TV on it, however.
Okay. Well, definitely check that out. That's going to be a great episode. On ESVN, we spoke at length about Lamar Jackson's contract situation, what it means for a player of his caliber to represent himself without an agent, how the union's positioned in the situation, and how the billionaires always win. Plus some March Madness stuff with Will from Indiana, and, you know, Aaron Rodgers' watch. We did that on Monday, and more things at youtube.com/ESVN show. And, oh! Very nice. There's Bradley. Hi. And there's Brandon. We can't hear you.
Oh, we can't hear you, Brandon.
Might need I'm just muted there. Just, you know, had my Zoom meeting settings on.
Ah, well, I mean, that's better than saying something you don't mean. I don't know. What's happening on the discourse?
Yes. I was able to get the last episode out where we talk about our various feelings about Black History Month and where I was able to predict, you know, maybe a day ahead. So if you were listening to the Discourse premium show infrequently, as it is, you would have known that Signature Bank was going to collapse perhaps a day before it happened. So, you know, that's just a little plug of my foresight. And then we talk a little bit about the 2024 election, what we're expecting, Trump versus DeSantis, et cetera. Looking forward to a lot more drama, I suppose. Dirty hands to Santis.
Exactly. All right. Well, check that out. What's up, Matt Binder? What's happening over on Scam Economy and Doomed?
Hello, everybody. There's a few things happening over at Scam Economy and Doomed. You could check out this week's episode of Scam Economy with my guest, Edward Angueso Jr. We spoke we spoke about the fall of Silicon Valley Bank, the crying, whiny, crybaby tech VCs who begged for the government to save them. And we also spoke about the differences and similarities between the fall of Silicon Valley Bank and then the two crypto-friendly banks that also went under this past week, Signature Bank and Silvergate. That's at youtube.com/MattBinder and scameconomy.com. For doomed podcast listeners, I have some episodes I have not uploaded yet to the podcast feed for you to check out at doomedcast.com. And Leftist Mafia tonight, you can check that out. And that's what's going on in my world this week.
Awesome. I mean, Slate just keeps hiring some of the really great reporters out there. Like first Sam, Alex Salmon gets hired by Slate, and then Edward.
I think this was just a piece that he did for them. He's not officially with Slate.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Yeah,
sorry.
But they published it. So I mean, they're picking up some good stuff.
All right. Well, definitely check that out. We will head into the fun half now. As I mentioned, the number is 646-257-3920. See you there.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, no. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 boy is back, and the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy is back, and the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, back, back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bank, okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on!
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.